Welcome to the Natural Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Whitfield Cook. Join us as we interview expert clinicians, researchers, and well-being experts from around the world and explore the evidence and application of complementary medicine in global healthcare. The following podcast is intended as professional information for integrative medicine practitioners and as such must not be taken as medical advice. Patients are expressly directed to seek appropriate care from a suitably qualified practitioner. Welcome to the Natural Medicine Podcast and thanks for your company. I'm Andrew Whitfield Cook. We're going to be learning a heck of a lot today from Nicole Hannon, who's an Olympic volleyballer. She's done her master's and now she's doing a PhD studying eosinophilic esophagitis. Welcome to Natural Medicine Podcast, Nicole. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for having me. And big congratulations for being able to say that without stumbling over your words.
Was this take 10? No. So Nicole, you and I have podcasted before, but I think we need to backtrack. And just for people that might not know you, take us a little bit through your history from an Olympian to a naturopath.
Oh, gosh, yes. Well, Olympians seems like a million years ago, a lifetime ago, although I'm kind of revisiting aspects of that now and getting into coaching at that high level. So I'm enjoying that, but that's a big story for another time. I went from being an athlete to studying naturopathy. And right at the end of my naturopathy degree, I had my daughter. And she was diagnosed very early on with eosinophilic esophagitis. So at 7 months old, she underwent an endoscopy and biopsies, et cetera. And we learned about this new disease that I never knew existed before. And as is often the way with mums of kids who have various different diseases, disorders, health issues, we become the warriors and need to find the information. And so I grabbed onto it with both hands and sort of dived in to try and find solutions for us as a family and for my daughter, but also for other families who are living with this disease. So after I finished my naturopathy degree and I worked in clinical practice with a number of children and adults who have eosinophilic esophagitis, I ended up doing a Master of Medical Research degree, and my project was looking at children who had EOE. Sorry, I'm just going to call it EOE from now on. It's much easier to say. And I surveyed parents of children who had EOE and asked them about their experiences and their concerns and, you know, who they had seen for treatment and what sorts of treatments they'd used, and also looked at symptom scores, as in severity of symptoms for the children and health-related quality of life. And so we collected a huge amount of data and had a number of really great publications out of that, which was super interesting. And now I pretty much jumped straight out of that into a PhD. And the idea of this PhD is looking at adults who have EOE, so jumped away from that pediatric side of things. And one of the main reasons for that was, firstly, it's never been looked at with complementary medicine. And secondly, because I would like to culminate this project in a pilot trial of a complementary medicine and find some evidence, establish some evidence for what sorts of complementary medicines might be able to be used to help patients with EOE.
Well, let's go through exactly what EOE is and indeed what it isn't.
Okay. So EOE is an inflammatory antigen-driven Th2 dominant disorder of the gastrointestinal tract. So essentially when a person who has EOE comes into contact with an antigen or their body perceives as an allergen, there is a mass influx of eosinophils to the gastrointestinal tract. And in the case of EOE, it's to the esophagus, although it's the most common of a group of disorders called eosinophilic gastrointestinal disorders. And the name generally refers to the area of the gastrointestinal tract that those eosinophils cluster. So EoE is the esophagus, eosinophilic gastritis, the stomach, eosinophilic duodenitis, the duodenum, and so on. But as a group, they're called EGIDs, eosinophilic gastrointestinal disorders.
Right. So, okay, question about that. Why would an eosinophil, which is normally a cell which migrates throughout the whole body in surveillance mode, why would it congregate in one length of a tissue? That's just weird. That's just mind-blowing.
Look, there's so much. I guess it's easy to say there's very little known about it, but we are actually starting to make leaps and bounds in the understanding of what causes EoE. It's still not entirely understood, but because the prevalence is increasing very, very fast, more and more research is done. There's a huge spike in, if you search PubMed eosinophilic esophagitis and you look at the little timeline, you know, that little what do you call it, a bar graph, it just goes whoop like this, and you can just see how massive that increase in research is. And so we are starting to understand it a bit more, but interestingly, different things happen in different parts of the gastrointestinal tract. And I guess because food allergens are one of the main triggers, it sort of makes sense that because the food's touching that gastrointestinal tract, that's where the eosinophils are clustering. Sure. Except the mechanisms are slightly different depending on where it's happening.
Yeah.
And there are, food is the most common cause, but there's also environmental and chemical allergens that can cause eosinophilic esophagitis. So you do see quite a few people who have reactions that are caused by things like dust mites and grass pollens and even things like smoke from bushfires. And there's a number of different things that can actually cause reactions that you wouldn't really think of.
Gotcha. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's so many questions that stem from that, you know, why it would be restricted to a certain organ, let's say the stomach, the esophagus, the, you know, duodenum, whatever. Mm-hmm. And the other one is, if we're talking about dust mites and we're talking about inhaled allergens, therefore can other tissues apart from the gastrointestinal tract be involved?
Well, funny you should mention that. A high percentage, I think it's around 80% last time I looked, of patients who have EoE also have atopic disease. So you often see asthma, which as we know is very much eosinophil driven. So it's not all cases, and there are a number of different phenotypes. We see different presentations of EoE, but it is much more common in patients who have atopic disease.
Another question about if people are often atopic, something that I know I've discussed with you previously, and I might have been actually off camera, it might have been after the podcast, we were discussing the TRPV1 receptor. Well, I know there's a family of them, the TRPV family, previously called the vanilloid receptor, and it's the receptor that triggers with chili. So tell us
and
about...
And cigarette smoke, I believe, as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, tell us about this. What's the importance of it? What's so important about the TRPV1?
Oh, look, I'm not an expert in the TRPV1 receptor. I'm not an immunologist or allergist, but I do know that it can be triggered by various sort of often strong substances. I think things like mustard, like those very strong pungent spices can often be things that trigger it. And I'm pretty sure cigarette smoke is one of them as well. And I do know that people with EoE, I know that there has been a link with EoE, but like I said, I couldn't speak to the details of that. I know that I've read about it. It's not everywhere in the literature, but I know that it is related.
So therefore, stemming from that, is it known if cultures around the equator, particularly like, you know, those in a more tropical climate, those who eat more spicy foods, if they're more susceptible to EoE from a cultural perspective, or if they're if they've got less of a prevalence of a penetration in the population with EoE?
That is such a great question. I love that. I love how your mind works. You went to this really random thing, and I love it. I there isn't actual research about that I'm aware of. What we do know is that it's more common in Western countries. And so I think the kind of population that you're talking about wouldn't necessarily fall into that category. But my question would then be, it's not necessarily that it's not a thing. It's maybe that healthcare systems work differently. Yeah. The way that we diagnose EoE is very invasive and requires a lot of medical intervention and monitoring. It's endoscopy and biopsy only. And so I feel like, you know, there may be a lag in that diagnosis, whether it's actually truly about that diet and environment, or whether it's about that lack of diagnosis in those areas, absolutely. I'm not sure. So that would be an interesting study in itself, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, of course, it goes along with that as well, about strong things like cigarette smoke. Hmm. If there's a strong issue with cigarette smoke, is it seen in Western societies? What about, say, Japan, where cigarette smoking is rife, and they're a pretty westernized culture? But again, it comes down to the healthcare system, and are they open to looking for it?
I believe it is quite high in Japan, actually. I think that it's quite high in Asian populations, Western Asian population.
Right.
And more common in males, quite a lot more common in males than in females.
Okay. Has anybody looked at, say, gene clusters or anything like that?
Yeah.
Gene SNP clusters?
There's a lot of research about the genetic involvement, and I believe it's something around 1 in 8. I haven't revisited that recently, but I believe it's something around 1 in 8 parents who were randomly part of a trial of children who had EoE, and then they did an endoscopy and biopsy of the parent, and 1 in 8 parent had it and didn't even know that they had it in many of the cases.
So that again flows on to my next question, and that is, what about undiagnosed adults, where previously we weren't looking for it? So of course we never found it. We were probably diagnosed as GERD or GORD or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. Possibly looking for a hiatus hernia or a sliding hiatus hernia or some other sort of disorder, potentially in kids, things like pyloric stenosis and things like that, that were well accepted as existing many years ago. Do you find that adults are resurfacing or are surfacing in your research?
Absolutely. The thing with EoE is that it presents differently at different stages in life and depending on how long you've been symptomatic as well. So sometimes people will go along just nicely and something will trigger it, and so they might not actually become symptomatic until later. And then, so for those adults who end up getting diagnosed a little bit later, often the trigger for that diagnosis is that they've presented to an emergency department with food impaction. So that's now recognized as the EoE is now recognized as the number one cause of unexplained food impaction for patients who present to an emergency department. So that would be a really big flag that I would love to make sure that people are listening to. If a patient shows up to you and one of the things they say to you is, I have difficulty swallowing food, or food always gets stuck in my throat, or they have had even one episode of food impaction, food getting stuck in their esophagus and them not being able to get it out, the number one cause of that is EoE. And that's worldwide recognized.
Wow. Okay, so I have to go there. And I'm sorry to do the sort of thing. But I have noticed this with a few people who, when they eat certain foods, and it's even cold versus hot, you know, foods, but let's say chicken. Hot chicken, no problem. Cold chicken, and depending on the site of the meat as well, whether it be a leg versus breast, thigh versus breast, that it can sort of get caught in the gullet. But my automatic suspicion would be there. A hiatus hernia or sliding hiatus hernia, something like that. That would be my first go. So when do you start to go, hang on, there's something else going on here? It's not just food getting caught in your gullet. What are the other things that go along with it?
Well, I think this is where our experience as case takers, as naturopaths, nutritionists, we are able to ask all the surrounding questions. So straight away, I mean, I'm obviously very sensitive to if someone says, oh, I drink lots of water when I eat. Oh, you might have it. So right. I'm looking for it. So I would probably be more likely to see it than anyone else. And that is one of the signs, drinking lots of water, just because you can't swallow the food. And the reason for this is that because of that infiltration of the eosinophils in the esophagus, over time, that continual inflammation causes damage to the tissues that then over time causes scarring, and you can end up with concentric rings, fibrotic scarring in the esophagus, and it narrows the esophagus, and there's no room for the food to get down. And sometimes that can become very extreme if you don't pay attention to it early. And it's in many cases irreversible if you don't get onto it early. And so some people just persist with this. Oh, it'll be right. Oh, I just need to chew. I've heard so many people, husbands and wives, and one of them saying, oh, I feel so bad because our whole marriage, I've just said, you just need to chew. You're eating too fast. You just need to chew your food better. And so I think that those sort of little questions can actually make a really big difference to your differential diagnosis. And often when you said that about the chicken and the temperature, often to me, that would require more questions about the temperature, because I would be thinking, could it be something related to that that's nothing to do with EOE?
Yeah.
Just because things get cold and dry and they are actually harder to swallow for anyone, let alone someone who had EOE. But often it's a certain thing. So you might go, every time I eat eggs, I struggle, or every time I eat chicken, it's really hard for me to swallow. And then you have to differentiate between some people will say they don't eat meat because it's hard to swallow. Well, meat's kind of harder to swallow, and it's more fibrous, and it's, if you don't chew it up well, it is harder to swallow. So is it that food in particular is a trigger and is causing inflammation and it, like at that moment, or is it that you've got existing scarring and any of those foods that are tougher to swallow are going to be a problem? Yet the trigger is something completely different. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
So it could be that milk is your trigger, because that's the most common trigger. I think in about 80% of cases, milk is the most common trigger.
Right. Okay.
And So
another question would be, you know, we're taught as naturopaths that about the cephalic phase of digestion, that the first phase of digestion starts in your head, not your mouth. But then, of course, we're taught to help digestion and to stop big clumps of antigens entering your gut and to reduce the immune impact, that we're taught to chew the food more readily, which may, of course, help the passage of food in someone with EOE, but of course then exposes those antigens to a wider surface area. So I was thinking, like, okay, so does chewing the food reduce or dampen the immune response in EOE, or does indeed chewing the food worsen the immune response in EOE?
I have never read anything about that. I don't.
Okay.
I doubt we know. I've never seen that actually looked at.
Just me being weird again.
Yeah.
but there's another question I had, and that is, do you see a greater prevalence of people with EOE suffering, if it's long-term, particularly undiagnosed, with Barrett's esophagitis and really severe precancerous conditions?
I have seen research to show that you are at a higher risk of Barrett's esophagus if you have EOE. Gotcha. There are There are a number of different diseases that seem to be more common comorbidities with EOE. And like I said, the atopic disease is one of them, is the most likely one, but also Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, right. Celiac disease is another one, and they're actually reasonably frequent. Right. So you might be looking at, you might have someone that you're just working with for celiac, and maybe you're struggling a little bit. Well, if they're having any of these symptoms that we've been talking about, then maybe there's a couple of things going on.
Okay. So therefore we're looking at the sort of, you know, more chronic immune mediated disorders.
But also Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is more common.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And EOE is more common in children who have, whose mothers have Hashimoto's. It's really, there's some really interesting links out there.
Yeah. That's really weird with EDS, one would think that there's more of an elastic tissue in the gut, but of course it's poor structural integrity, so it may lead. Oh my god, okay, there's so much to learn.
And mast cell disorders, those are more common in patients with EOE.
Okay, so assessments. Now we've spoken about gastroscopy. I remember you telling me that the eosinophils congregate in patches and they form white patches. Is that right?
But sometimes they look white, but sometimes you can't see them and they're still congregating.
Mm. Right. So how do you know where to sample from? How does a gastroenterologist know where to sample from?
This is why they, well, if you're someone who's having an endoscopy, you need to make sure that they're doing multiple biopsies at multiple sites, because you could just potentially have missed the entire cluster and get a no diagnosis, or that you don't have it when you actually do have it, because the biopsy's been done in the wrong spot. And so that kind of covers your bases a little bit. It's definitely not foolproof, but there are a few other ways of doing the diagnosis now and monitoring. There's what they call the cytosponge. It's essentially a string test. It's like a little string stays outside your mouth. You swallow it and it stays in they're slightly different, but they stay in the stomach. They expand and then they get pulled back up and take a sample of the tissues from the esophagus on the way back up. But there is some good evidence for both of those, and that neither of them are actually done in Australia at this stage, that neither of them are regulated by the TGA, but they are done in the United States.
Certainly not a pleasant investigation.
No, but the overwhelming response from people who have EOE that often require invasive monitoring, so general anaesthetic, endoscopy, biopsy, the overwhelming preference is to have the cytosponge or the string test in place of the endoscopy, because it could be every 3 months monitoring if you're doing food elimination and having to see whether it works or doesn't work, because sometimes symptoms aren't always an accurate reflection of what's actually going on in terms of eosinophil counts.
Yeah.
And so it is quite popular for that reason. There is a transnasal endoscopy, which can be, I believe, done in a chair. I don't want to give too much information on that because I'm not exactly sure in terms of what sort of sedation would need to be done or what sort of...
For sure.
Yeah, there'd have to be some sort of, I guess, sedation is not the right word, anesthetic on that. Yeah. It might just be a topical anesthetic, because if a biopsy is being taken, they would... I imagine do some sort of pain relief for that. So that, I do believe that that's starting to be done in Australia, but I'm pretty sure that the string test and the cytosponge are not available here yet, because I was looking for my clinical trial and we weren't able to get it here yet.
Gotcha. And of course, we have to talk about treatment. I mean, this is paramount. So once we get a diagnosis of EOE, versus the cluster of other symptoms or conditions that it could be, how do you initiate treatment both as a child, for a child, and for an adult? Because you say it presents differently. Mm. So What sort of things do you look at? Is it always an elimination diet first?
Well, firstly, I probably haven't said anything about how children present, and that's probably quite important for this discussion, is just to mention that children, especially in the early stages before a huge amount of damage has been done to the esophagus, they can present quite differently to adults. So food impaction may not be the first thing that you see. You'll often see sort of more general reflux that doesn't respond to PPI therapy. And often the kids that come in that you will see will be on a PPI because that will be one of the first line therapies, although that's starting to shift a little bit. But until you identify what the triggers are for that child, they might be having sleep issues, abdominal pain, chest pain, or saying that things are hard to swallow. Sometimes when they're little, they actually walk around holding a little cup and spitting into it because they're finding it hard to swallow their food, or they might be spitting food back up, chewing it and spitting it out instead of because it hurts to swallow it.
Right.
So food aversion is one of the big things with kids. Also, there can be tummy things. So diarrhea and vomiting can be related with children. You can see that in children.
Okay. And babies, what about infants? How young have you heard it occurring or presenting?
From birth. My daughter was from birth. Yeah.
So screaming, straight away, fussing with feeding, the whole gamut.
Just basically threw up everything, failure to thrive early on. They don't always present like that though, so it can be very tricky. It can be a tricky road with a little one because we were told as parents, you know, oh, you're first-time parents, babies cry, it's just a bit of reflux or it's just a bit of colic, and she'll be right. Go and have a cup of tea and pop her in a cot and don't pick her up every time she cries, you know, that sort of thing, which was just not helpful. And we really had to fight for that support and diagnosis.
Yeah, the thing that's really weird there is in all cases of failure to thrive, it should be investigated in every case.
Absolutely.
Regardless of cause.
Absolutely. So when I was in clinical practice, I'm not really in clinical practice anymore. I'm doing research. And when I was, I just loved working with young families who had kids and were going through what we went through, because it was just lovely to be able to support them through that. And back to your previous question about what you do, one of the main things that I think is really important for practitioners to hear is to be accepting of where that family is at on their journey. And I think as complementary medicine practitioners especially, we're sort of programmed to say, oh, pharmaceuticals are bad and PPIs are bad. And, you know, it's like this, we want to immediately reach in and take away these things that we sort of perceive we've got a better solution for. And I think that we need to be really very, very careful about that, especially with this disease, because sometimes often those are the things that are making it manageable and, you know, keeping that family sane. And so it's a matter of tread carefully, tread lightly, rather than going in and adding things. You're better off looking at what could be triggering this. How can we identify the thing? And so often it's about taking away rather than adding in. So although we might want to jump in with like, oh, slippery elm, it's so soothing and let's try that, these people can be really, really sensitive and you have to be very careful about one thing at a time. And so if you were to try slippery elm, for example, I would try it by itself, not with lots of other things in a mix of you know, some sort of powder of lots of different things, because if they react to something, you're really not sure of what it is they reacted to, because there's 10 ingredients in that thing. So
And I think two points there. One is that this is where prackies sometimes start to blame a product rather than an ingredient, and that's not really helpful or science. But the other thing is, I remember us talking about that sometimes the most seemingly innocuous ingredient can cause the greatest flare.
Absolutely. And so firstly, I wanted to make sure that I say that I'm not recommending slippery elm, and that's not what I was doing there. It was just the first thing that popped into my mind. There is, at this stage, no clinical evidence, no evidence whatsoever other than anecdotal evidence for any complementary medicine in eosinophilic esophagitis. We don't have any clinical trials. Gotcha. So that's what I'm doing with my research, is trying to establish some evidence. So we have that to draw on when we're prescribing. Sorry, I got carried away with that thought and forgot what you asked me.
about treatments. And in there, I have to slide a second sort of question in there about, we've never spoken about prevalence in the community. So what is the assumed prevalence? Do we know it?
It's going up and up and up. When I first started researching this about, must have been 11, 12 years ago, they were looking at 1 in 10,000 in most Western populations. Now it's 0.5 to 1 in 2,000.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I actually think that that's underdone, to tell you the truth. And the prevalence is increasing at such a rapid rate. But it's also important to note that that is not, it's a true prevalence increase. It's not due to higher recognition and more investigations. So it is a true prevalence increase. And there have been studies to show that. Gotcha. And I remembered what it was you asked me. It was about elimination diets.
Yeah.
That we asked me. Yeah. So
yeah, about treatments. Yeah.
Treatments. So the first thing would be to try and identify what it is that is the trigger. And there was a really great paper that was written a couple of years ago that was exciting for me to find, because I was seeing in clinical practice that although most of the research in AOE was about this top six or top eight diet, where it only removed six different foods or eight different foods, I was finding that there were triggers that were things that we think, oh no, but it can't be that. It's not one of the top allergens. Things like rice, corn, potato, beef, chicken, things that, so normally you'd go in an elimination diet, you'd take out wheat and then you'd throw in a whole bunch of corn and rice to fill up the bit where wheat got chucked out. And if either of those were your triggers, if rice or corn were your triggers, you're in big trouble.
And they're supposedly more hypoallergenic, certainly rice.
Yeah. And so one of the things that I've actually changed my stance in recent times, and it has been because of more recent research, is I used to be a lot more pro taking everything out. And now I feel like there's quite a bit of research to say the very first thing you need to try is a super strict dairy elimination. And because that is the most common trigger, if you do that first and you don't see any change, then I would go ahead and start looking at pulling out the others. And so it would depend on the case, the individual case, as to what you would choose next. But I guess my main point would be, yes, try the big ones, try the top six and the top eight, but always consider what's actually happening. Do really thorough case taking. Be aware of what you've brought in when you've taken something else out, and make sure that you don't change too many variables at one time when you're doing elimination diets, because you just won't know what's going on if you change multiple things at one time.
Can it be as simple in an infant as A, changing from breast to formula, or formula back to breast? B, what about the different types of formulas, milk to goats or milk to, heaven forbid, soy? I'm not a fan of soy formula, but.
So it really depends on the individual, because there's sort of a big spectrum of how severe it is and how many triggers. Some people reacted almost everything, which was my daughter, and had to live on an elemental formula. So this is a special free amino formula that she lived on. That she had to have it until she was 5 years old, because she didn't have enough safe foods to be able to survive on
food. How did she cope with the taste?
It's so funny. She even says to me now, I used to really like that formula, and it was it was so gross. I couldn't even stand the smell of it. unflavored, because she reacted to any of the flavored ones as well. So it was just an unflavored free amino formula, which is just bleh. And she had to have it very diluted, because it's got a high osmolality. It has a high osmolality, so it's quite burning on the gut if you have it at the full strength. And sometimes I've encountered people who have children on that elemental formula, and it can almost be as simple sometimes as, well, you're having it at full strength, why don't you pull it back to 75% strength, as in like less powder, more water. They'll be coping so much better just because you've slightly changed the dilution.
Right. So at full strength, could it indeed worsen or be a factor in food impaction?
I wouldn't say necessarily in the food impaction, but I would say that some people just tolerate the formula in terms of that inflammation or sensation and symptomatic, how they explain their symptoms, and they just feel a lot more, they can feel a lot more comfortable. And I know that babies can be a lot more settled, sleep a lot better, be less fussy if you do that. But one thing that is really important is making sure that they're still getting the same number of scoops that they need to survive each day. So if they need 10 scoops, like say, then they have to still make sure they get that 10 scoops and they're not just pulling out.
So you've got to it's a longer feed time. You raise a really important point there, Nicole, and that is that, you know, with babies, we look at symptoms like fussing, settled, crying, things like that. They can't elucidate any more than that. But that also progresses to infants and young children, where they can't identify pain. They'll go, their tummy's sore, but it could be their hip. So how do you work your way through that? I mean, this is obviously from experience, but how do you help, let's say, help other prackies who are listening today to look for signs about where is that pain?
I think if I could answer this question, I would be helping parents everywhere, because they feel like until they're, it must be about 8. I don't know how old it is, maybe 7. I can't remember when we finally got to the point of, you're actually explaining it how I need it explained now. I think it's just observing everything as a whole. And like in my personal experience, I still couldn't rely on that. My tummy hurts for such a long time. Yeah. One of the things that was definitely a clue for me of, is this a reaction or is this an actual tummy pain, was hiccups. So hiccups is a sign of reflux, and hiccups were a very common occurrence when my daughter was having an EoE reaction. Or she would say, I've got sickies in my throat. So those were two of the main ones, sickies in her throat and hiccups. And so that I'd keep an eye out for those, because I have seen that quite a lot in other children as well. And even I've done like a little mini surveys of mums who've had, I always ask them, did your baby get hiccups a lot when you were pregnant? And most of them say all the time.
That's really interesting, because that's a diaphragmatic inflammation or irritation.
Yeah, it's just an interesting one. Yeah.
Very interesting. I've written down, there's so many questions I've got here, Nicole. Let's go further into treatments. So what about, you know, we've got failure to thrive, so we've got to be careful that they're getting enough protein, carbs, fats. Do you look at supplementing any type of particular nutrients, like for instance fish oils or essential fatty acids in some liquid form, the elemental diet, forgive me, which to me is often based on rice, isn't it?
They're all different. There's and some of them work for some EoE babies, children, and others can be very reactive. So some of them have soy, some of them have rice, some of them have coconut. And so those can be, the medium chain triglycerides can be in there from coconut. And that can be enough to make that formula reactive for a child. And so you have to marry up the different formulas and see which one. Sometimes you have to go through a number of them to be able to find the right one.
Gotcha. Right. Okay.
And generally, it's elemental formulas, unless dairy is the only trigger. If dairy was the only trigger, then any of those, there's that rice-based formula, which isn't a free amino formula. It's just a rice-based protein. So that would work as long as it's not dairy.
Yeah, got it. And the other one, of course, that would be a very common treatment for any sort of gut disorder, probiotics. How important are they? What sort of cautions do we have to be aware of?
You have to be very careful with probiotics. I think that, you know, I think a lot of prackies are getting onto that, really understanding that probiotics need to be strain specific and disease specific. And realistically, we don't have any research on EOE and probiotics. So there isn't any that I would specifically recommend because of that. I would be looking, if anything, if you were going to try something, one probiotic that I've found has worked reasonably well in my clinical practice, and once again, there is no evidence for this in EOE from a clinical perspective, would be SB. So, yeah. And I found that was a really big game changer for my daughter specifically, but it has worked quite well for a number of other patients in clinical practice. I would also be looking at some of those probiotics that are specific for atopic disease. So because so there
LGG,
is that...
LGG, HN001, those sort of lactobacillus rhamnoses.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. LGG is the big one.
Yeah.
So I would be looking at those, but again, it would be a trial and error thing, and it may not work because we don't know if they work for EOE. But those would be the ones that I would be leaning towards if I was going to try any.
Do you tend to try a single species or strain so that you can monitor it more easily? Or what about using a concoction of a broad spectrum?
I would be hesitant on the broad spectrum just because I like that specificity and making sure that we're targeting it correctly. So
is that fine iris of yours coming out again, Nicole?
Yeah. And I guess you can try what you can try, but then maybe for me, if you can try and find other foods or supplements that would be more from a prebiotic perspective than a probiotic, then we're looking at really building that gut flora, you know, more holistically. Yeah, and
absolutely.
Using food sources.
So this was my next question, and that is that, you know, in Australia at least, we're restricted to, what is it, 14, 16 species, strains of probiotics, most of them, not all of them, but most of them originally from dairy origins. And we have to be mindful that some of the most important species of gut microbiota like Akkermansia muciniphilia and Faecalibacterium prausnitzii are just two of the ones that we don't have any supplements of these, and we have to think about how we're going to feed them. Of course, that's largely plant-based diets. Weirdly, you're going to get issues in what you can feed your child, even adult with EOE. So
yeah, and I think, you know, the majority of the cases are not quite that. They're not all the super sensitive end of the spectrum. You might find some that just have a few and they're actually okay with most things.
Got it.
But my focus would be on building those good gut bacteria with food sources where you can. And I sometimes have used partially hydrolyzed guar gum. I have used inulin as prebiotics in their care, but I would always only do one at a time and do it slowly and carefully and see if there's a reaction. Then I would be looking at, you know, your standard sort of prebiotic food, your polyphenols and, you know, your berries and your red rices and black rice and those sorts of things. So just getting them in from the foods where you can.
What about nutrients that heal? Like, for instance, rather than you can use just zinc, but there's also things like zinc carnosine. Mm. And just recently, there's been a product released, a zinc carnosine chew, finally. Like, why did we not do this previously? But, you know, so that people can get the relief from, you know, the nasopharynx down or the pharynx down. Do you find these helpful at all? Do you find any nutrients of value? I'm wondering about the concomitants with EDS and things like that, where you need tissue healing. Collagen, for instance.
And that is one that I have used, especially if there's a protein deficiency, because if it's, let's say there's a fish allergy, a true fish allergy, and then there's damage already and they're having trouble swallowing meats, for example. If I wanted to get that sort of pure form of protein, I might use collagen. And I have used that quite a bit in my clinical practice and found it's worked really well. And when I say worked well, I think it's met that protein need and done and had some symptomatic relief, but I don't think it's a cure as such for EoE. No. Unfortunately, EoE is just this nasty disease that you actually have to take the trigger away. There's no take it away and then next week you'll be fine because you had a break. It just seems to be one of these things that, unfortunately, more often than not, once you've got it and once that's your trigger, unless you avoid that trigger, you sort of have it. And so one thing, it's funny, in my own personal experience, my daughter has had monumental changes and she actually can eat almost everything now. And I sort of don't really know how we did it because I haven't seen that happen in clinical practice and I haven't seen it in the literature. And I think that it was just very, very careful management early on and a lot of work on and using my nutrition backgrounds for food as medicine to try and build up that gut flora and avoid nasty foods and things that I knew were going to cause inflammation and damage. And it's just been this sort of slow, progressive thing that gradually, like, oh wow, you're okay with that now, and then 6 months later, oh my goodness, you can have this thing that you've never been able to have, and we've just sort of got to this spot where it's really great. And I'm sort of still in that, like, is it gonna stay like this, like,
you know, hypervigilance.
A bit of PTSD from managing this disease for so long, but it seems pretty good at this stage. In terms of other supplements, I think it's very individual and very specific as to what, how they're presenting. And you do need to just put your naturopath nutritionist cap on and go, you know, are they deficient in certain things, and then supplement them carefully, slowly, use the best forms you can. The zinc L-carnosine I have used before. One caution would be never, ever use zinc sulfate with any of these people. And I think that you need to carefully go through what they're having, because most over-the-counters zinc supplements are zinc sulfate, and they can just be absolutely awful on the gut and cause a lot of pain. And then just doing your general audit that you would do of supplements. And I think that often it's about taking things out and then slowly bringing things back in one at a time and seeing what you can do, because often people are actually reacting to the supplements, medicines. You know, they might be doing some nice powder that they found online that's meant to do all these amazing things, and they could be reacting to whether it be flavors or colors or sweeteners or the actual ingredients in those supplements. So we do need to be careful. And I think doing that really careful audit early on in the journey with a patient in that first consult is very, very important.
Well, there's so much to learn, so much to learn. It's not just a PhD's worth, but certainly worthy of a course or a book. but there's one last question I need to ask you, Nicole, and that is, with the patients that you've seen, response time to an allergen and conversely, response to healing, a resolution of an eosinophilic reaction. Do we find that this is quite quick, like an asthmatic type reaction you mentioned, or do you have the delayed hypersensitivity?
It can be both depending on where you're at in the disease, but I would say, especially when you're trying to bring things back in, I would always give it a week, if not 2 weeks, to slowly ramp up the amount to really see if you're reacting. I do find that taking things out, you can see improvements quite quickly. So within a week, I would say that you would see an improvement in various symptoms. So it's really, really important to do regular symptom monitoring. And there are some really good tools, validated tools out there. So if you look into some research about symptom monitoring for EOE, there'll be plenty of papers out there that use a number of different validated tools for, so you could find those for your clinical practice. PESV2, PESV2 is one of the surveys that's about symptom monitoring. And so that's a good one to check in with. And there's also a quality of life one that can be used as well, which is, I can give you some information about that to put in the notes.
Yes, we will definitely put all of this information as much as we can up in the notes. Mm-hmm. And certainly we'll be spreading this information. You and I have done a recording previously. We've got a call out. So I'm just going to ask you to do a brief recap of that call out, just so that people can link that. Now, you know, that will have finished, if you like, by the time this podcast goes to air. But you're now involved with your PhD in doing later on a clinical trial. But firstly, you need working groups. What do you?
So I'm looking for focus groups. So I'm doing focus groups of complementary medicine practitioners in Australia who have worked with at least one patient, with adult patient, I should say, with EOE in the last 5 years. And really all you need to be is a degree or diploma qualified, advanced degree or diploma qualified naturopath, nutritionist, or Western herbal medicine practitioner. You need to be have a membership with a professional association and have worked with one patient who is an adult in your clinical practice. And you don't need to be an expert, you just need to have seen someone so you can share your experiences and thoughts about how that went. And we will be, I'm not sure when this podcast is going to come out, but we do have a little bit of time.
I'm going to be putting it up as soon as I can.
Yeah, so hopefully if it's still open, there'll be an expression of interest to participate in that. We would love to hear from you. It's a 90-minute chat, essentially. And the other part of it is a survey, which I believe we're going to close at the end of September, but I'm not sure. We might extend it if we're getting lots more interest. So that's an international survey: Australia, New Zealand, the UK, the USA, and Canada. And we're surveying adults who have EOE and just asking them about their experiences and what sort of conventional and complementary medicine help they've sought and what their experiences and perceptions are about that. So we're using both of those practitioner and patient perspectives to find out more information that will inform a pilot trial. So my end game is to identify a complementary medicine that we can use in a pilot trial to see whether it works, whether it's safe, what kind of dose we need for adults who have EOE, to see if we can get some relief for these people and have some hard and fast evidence for complementary medicine use.
Nicole, thank you so much for joining us today. It's so evident, not just that you've got a passion because you've got a family member, but you've now carrying that torch, if you like, for other patients and other practitioners to help their patients. It's wonderful what you're doing. Hopefully this will be groundbreaking research that you'll do to, you know, put, if you like, complementary medicine in this arena on the map. So thank you so much for sharing your wealth of experience today. It's just awesome talking to you again.
Thank you so much for having me. I feel very privileged to be a part of your podcast and get to chat with you and answer your wacky questions.
and thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Remember, we will put all the links that we can up on this podcast, whatever we can. And please share the hell out of this. This is so important to get this message out to as many practitioners as we can, as many patients as we can, really quickly. So thank you once again, Nicole. Thanks, everybody, for your time. I'm Andrew Whitfield-Cook.